back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 23B, The Battle of Bunker Hill, part 2. As I said last time, the Battle of Bunker Hill earns two episodes because, well, there's just so much going on that I can't keep it into the nice, compact time frame that I like to, so I didn't want to have an hour-long episode. So I decided to break it up into two parts, and this is going to be the battle section. Last week, we set the stage. Now, there was one thing I forgot to mention, and that was what's going on Bunker Hill. We did all this talking about Breed's Hill, and though it is the site of the battle, why do they still call it Bunker Hill? Well, the fact was is that the orders were given for the redoubt to be built on Bunker Hill, and so that the fact that there was a battle in adjacent to Bunker Hill, they just kind of left it the same. Made life a little easier. Now, Prescott is dealing with a lot. He has no food, no water for his men. They're tired. And as I left off, the British are coming. Now, the constant shelling, the lack of food, the lack of water, and now the sight of British boats coming across and landing troops. Well, some of the men were a little put off by that. And they'll start to, well, retreat from the redoubt. And they head back up towards Bunker Hill. They even take some of the entrenching tools with them. And as they're milling about on Bunker Hill, Old Putt rides up and he says, "Well, men, you've left the redoubt on Breed's Hill. Build a redoubt here." And he puts those that had evacuated the Breed's Hill redoubt to work building a secondary redoubt on Bunker Hill. In case the Americans fell back, they would have a fallback position. Now, the Bunker Hill redoubt won't come into play, not because it wasn't completed in time or it lacked any defensive capabilities. It was the fact that Prescott's men were out of ammunition when they're making their retreat. So they have no time to set up a new position because they have nothing to shoot with. So when the Americans evacuate Breed's Hill, they go all the way back across Charlestown Neck. Another thing that I didn't really get to go into is what the Navy is doing. I had mentioned that there was this failure to send the Navy ships in Boston Harbor on any kind of recon around the peninsula. And the failure to do so actually proved to be a negative outcome for the British. You see, when Howe is discussing the situation with Admiral Graves, they decide that they're going to set their ships up in the Charles River. And they also can't bring the Somerset and her 64 guns to bear in the fight because, well, she's just too deep a draft and she won't fit on the rivers. So they're using frigates and sloops. Now, had they reconned around the peninsula, they would have noticed that if you go to the Mystic River, not the Charles River, you can get farther up the peninsula, you could lay a better barrage on the Charlestown Neck, and the rail fences on that side. You could have easily broken up the defenses there. Thus, you would have changed the whole course of the battle very quickly. Because they were set up on the Charles River, it was actually easier for men to get across Charlestown Neck to reinforce those on Breed's Hill. So I talked about how worn out the troops were for Prescott, and how very much so they were in need of reinforcements, and in need of food and water. And Putnam had tried and tried as he may, but he could not get food or water sent to them. He did get reinforcements sent their way. That was in the form of John Stark and John Reed's 1st and 3rd New Hampshire, respectively. Now, being that Stark was the more senior commander, he will take overall command of the New Hampshiremen. He marches them to the top of Bunker Hill. They ascend the hill, and he confers with his officers the best place to set up. He probably didn't really do much talking with Putnam or Prescott, and he took it upon himself to take a position behind the rail fence. They would close the gap from Knowlton's men to the Mystic River. This will be a key position for the day, and Stark's men will prove themselves worthy to the task. Another reinforcement that a lot of people don't realize was there was the president of the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts, Dr. Joseph Warren. Now, Dr. Warren had been suffering from a headache early in the day, but when the firing on Breed's Hill began, he decides that he's going to take up his musket and he's going to join the fight. Now, when he gets there, It's not a surprise that Prescott and Putnam both try and offer up command to the provincial president. But he kindly declines and says that he's only there to help in any way that he can. He wants to fight. He's not there to command. And he leaves the command to the officers in charge. Howe's force consisted of about 2,300 men in total. 1,600 would make the first crossing, with the other 700 being held in reserve. Those that were held in reserve was the 1st Battalion of Marines and the 47th Regiment of Foot of the 2nd Brigade. Howe will take over the two flanking companies, the Grenadiers and Light Infantry, that were formed into two regiments of their own, along with the rest of the 2nd Brigade, the 5th, the 38th, the 43rd, and the 52nd. Howe wants to break his attack into two pieces. He's going to use a two-prong attack to overwhelm the American defenses. He will take the right wing. He's going to use the Grenadiers and Light Infantry, and he's going to use as a reserve force the 5th and 52nd. While the 43rd and the 38th are going to go with Brigadier General Robert Pigo, who is going to command the left wing and is going to assault the redoubt head-on. Now, before Howe even attacks, he calls for his reserve. He brings over the 47th and the 1st Battalion of Marines and sends them with Pigo. The British also brought over a couple batteries of artillery. They close the gap between the two wings and would lay a steady fire on the American redoubt to help cover the advance of the two forces. The Americans also had artillery of their own, but theirs was a little more sporadic and all over the place. Now, we know that Scarborough Gridley was the major in command of one battery. We also know that John Callender had been sent, and he was set up at the rail fence. And then there's Captain Samuel Trivett, who will command the third. In total, the Americans had about six guns, but their exact placement is all over, and we're not exactly sure where they're going to be at any given time. We do know that Gridley was in the vicinity of the rail fence, and Trivett was somewhere around the Fletches, as best as we can figure. The first assault will come when Howe launches an attack going up the Mystic River towards the rail fence. His plan is to have the light infantry companies move along the shore, with the Grenadiers heading directly at the rail fence, and having the 5th and 52nd dress off of them and move along the side of Breed's Hill. The plan was to overwhelm the American defenses there and then push up the hill and flank the redoubt. At the same time he's doing this, Pigo is leading the 43rd and 38th, along with the 47th and 1st Marines, as they're going to attack the front of the redoubt head-on. Now, they're running into a slight problem with their attack on the redoubt itself. You see, Pigo is leading his men up the hill, but they're taking fire from their flanks. The Navy had decided that they were going to burn the town so that they could push off any patriots that would be holding up at houses. So what they do is they either fire cannonballs with the incendiary materials inside, or they superheat solid round shot and fire it into the buildings. And being that they're wood buildings, that solid red-hot ball sitting there is going to cause a fire. So they start to burn Charlestown. Now, the town is burning, but not all the patriots in town have run off just yet. So as Pigo launches his attack, he's being fired at from the flanks from men in the town still. So he's heading up under that fire coming from the town. Now, they probably planned the beginning assault, but it's actually quite unique. Most subsequent assaults happened at the exact same time. Now, the first assault, you would figure, okay, we're going to step off at this time. But with every attack and repulse, the British seemed to start up again almost on cue. And it probably wasn't planned, because communications on an 18th century battlefield get very skewed very quickly. So as Howe was launching his attack, Pigo is launching his as well. So on the right wing, Howe's men have formed an alliance, and the light infantry regiment is actually moving towards going along the shore of the Mystic River and is going to try and outflank those who are in the fence. Now, when they make that assault, they're not realizing just how many men are behind the fence. Once again, recon comes into play here. And so the grenadiers are contending with the fences that are in front of them, and the light infantry is keeping pace with them, moving up the shoreline, along with the 52nd and 5th holding just behind the grenadier lines, moving along the hill. And it actually is a testament to the American patience and fortitude, because Stark holds his fire until they are in the right position, usually about 50, 60 yards. And when they get there, he has his men let loose a volley. And that volley decimates the light infantry and the grenadiers. That first volley shocked the line so bad that they begin to fall back. And Stark is continuing. He has his men three deep, so that when one line fires, the next rank fires into succession, then followed by the third. And while each line is firing, the other two are reloading. And they are continuing this withering fire. So the light infantry is getting slammed. The grenadiers are getting mowed down like grass. And Howe's attack is repulsed. His first attack is repulsed. Pigot runs into the same problem. Pigot moves up onto the front of the redoubt. Prescott, once again, holds his men. They're contending with fences on the top of the hill. Now, all these fences, this is the whole area is pasture land. So they're contending with the fences. And the fences are holding up the British. And when they get there, they get to that 50, 60-yard mark. Prescott orders his men to fire, and 700 muskets ring out, and the British line gets run down. Now, both lines retreat. Howe's men were very disordered. They were so shocked by this first attack that they almost turned and ran, and they were all disorganized. Pigot's men hold their order, they hold their lines, and they just fall back. Now, Howe's men have to be reorganized, and he gets ready to set up a new plan. Pigot's men are actually holding their own. They step back a little bit, just out of effective range of most muskets, but his men are laying down a steady exchange of fire with the Americans in the redoubt, so they're firing back and forth. He has to think of a new plan on how to ascend and take over the redoubt. Now, Howe gets his men back in order, and he now has to make a new plan. His new plan is simple. He's going to line his men up, the reserve groups and the grenadiers and light infantry. He's going to line them up, and they're going to once again assault the rail fence in unison. And they do. And once again, the men in the rail fence hold their discipline, and they fire in unison, and they start to really lay holes into – they start to break major holes into these British lines. It's so much so that the British actually cut and they try and run around to the side of the – and overtake the flank of the rail fence again. But this time it still doesn't work. And they cannot overtake the rail fence, so they're pushed back. Pigot this time is not only contending with being shot at from the redoubt, but those that were in those 60 or so Patriots that were in town have now moved to some trees and barns that are up on the hill and are firing into the British lines from covered positions. So, yes, burning the town got the Patriots out of the town, but the Americans just moved to a new position and were firing from cover. So Pigot is having to contend with that. Now, where is the American artillery? The British artillery is keeping up a steady fire and is doing their best to punch holes into the American lines. But what about the American artillery? Well, see, the American artillery was a bit of a problem child. They will never actually hold their own. When the sometime between the first and second assault, Callender pulls his guns away. He pulls his guns back to Breed's Hill. He argues when Putnam stops him that he's out of ammunition, and Putnam gets off his horse and looks in the caisson and says, well, there's ammo in here. So what's your excuse? Scarborough Gridley will pull his artillery back. It's actually only Captain Samuel Trivette that's going to earn the honors of the day, because he's going to hold his own, and he's actually going to reform his artillery to cover the retreat of the Americans eventually. Now, I'll explain in a little bit what happens to Gridley and to Callender for their perceived cowardice during the battle, but now the Americans have repulsed two attacks and laid heavy, heavy damage on these British units. Now it's time for the third. And Howe has no choice. He has to exploit the redoubt and overtake the hill. He's not going to overtake the rail fence. So what he does is he reorganizes his men, and he pushes them up the swampy side of the hill, the side that would be, well, I put in air quotes, impossible to pass. Then they push up that side. And as they're pushing up that side, they're contending with the men in the Fletches. And those Fletches are causing problems for the British, but they're eventually overtaken. And the British that are moving up the side of the hill are out of range of the men in the rail fence, so they, men in the rail fence, really can't do much to cover him. Or, I'm sorry, to cover the hill. So Howe pushes up the hill, and he's able to overtake the Fletches and eventually get to the top of the hill. Pigot, almost in unison, the third assault of the day, goes head-on into goes head-on against the redoubt. Now, the whole time, a lot of you are probably thinking, well, why are they not standing and fighting? Why are they marching against these fortified positions? The tactic of the day to take an enemy line is you fire a volley or two, and then you charge with bayonet. The British wanted to get close enough to charge with bayonet. And the first two attacks, they couldn't do it. The Americans repulsed them twice, and they could not bring the bayonets to bear. So what do? You attack a third time. And that's what they'll do. They'll attack a third time. And this time, Howe's plan works. He's able to outflank the redoubt. He's able to get to the top of the hill and flank the breastworks. As Pigot is launching his attack on the head of the redoubt, Howe has set himself up into a position to go sidelong on the breastworks and rake the inside of the breastworks with musket fire. Now this causes the men, it's a fight or flight at this point. They either fold off into the redoubt, or they hop out of the breastworks and they make a run for it. The men in the redoubts are actually surrounded on three sides now, and Prescott is running out of ammunition. Now this is early in the war. You're going to see, and if you watch any kind of Revolutionary War movie, there's always bayonets on both sides. The problem is that it's so early in the war that most Americans don't have bayonets. They have rifles, fowling guns for hunting birds, or they have, you know, their own muskets, but they use them for hunting. So what's the point of having a bayonet? There's no point to having a bayonet. So they can't use that formidable weapon that the British have made famous. So as Pigot is able to scale the redoubt and Howe's men are closing in around him, Prescott gives the order for his men to retreat. And they do. It's actually a sad tale, because one of the last people to leave the redoubt is Dr. Joseph Warren. Yes, our president of the Provincial Congress is the last man to leave the redoubts, and as he takes off running, he is shot. Now, there is a legend that a British officer recognizes Warren, takes a musket from one of his men, and fires and kills Warren, shooting him in the head. Now, I never usually buy into these tales. They're usually tall tales to win the respect and admiration of the respective populace. So, to say that, oh, we scored a major victory, we have killed Dr. Joseph Warren, a legendary son of liberty, I don't really buy it. What I think happened was, is that these men were running from the redoubt, and the British had continued firing as these men were retreating. And maybe tempers were up. Maybe they recognized Warren, and the tempers were high, and they fired a shot, and they killed him. Or maybe they just saw retreating soldiers, and they fired and killed a man. But nonetheless, Dr. Joseph Warren has been killed, and thus passes a great man and a great son of liberty. Now, the Battle of Bunker Hill is not remembered for its tactics or for, you know, some heroes of the day. It's remembered because it's a pure bloodletting. The British were not prepared for what the Americans were about to dish out, and they, in this first year of the war, have dished out two major and decisive victories, we'll call them, against the British. Lexington and Concord, we will call a victory. You sent this British force running. And though the British took the heights at Bunker Hill, you took out so many soldiers that the losses would be very difficult to recoup this early in the war. So yes, it is a major thumbs up to the Americans and a definite head nod to their readiness to bring on a full engagement with this British force. Now, as the men are retreating, they're heading back over Bunker Hill. But as I had said, there was limited protection with the breastworks that were being assembled. And they have no ammunition. Prescott was dangerously low on ammunition when the third assault happened. And so he was pretty much out of ammunition. So his men were retreating. The men in the Fletches were driven off. We had talked about how the artillery cut and run. All that's left was the rail fence, and that's an indefensible position when you don't add in the other areas. So Stark, it's probably a testament to his character and his leadership, simply gathers up his men. They about face and head back across Charlestown Neck with the rest. Now, that's not to say that the British were about to score any kind of major victory, because Putnam, once again, as he was setting up the works on the Bunker Hill, he organized another set of works to fall into line as a fallback position for the Americans at Winter Hill, which was just about a mile from Charlestown Neck. Now, this position was going to be used in case the British decide that they were going to follow up their victory on Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, and they were going to press on for the heights around town like the plan called for. But Howe couldn't do it. Of the 2,300 men that he brought into the battle, he will suffer 1,150 casualties. 1,150 killed, captured, or wounded. 800 men were killed. The Americans beat them back at practically point-blank range, and yet the British were still able to take the ground. Now, that is definitely a testament and a head nod to Howe's ability to command troops and to press an advantage whenever he sees it. But the Americans were ready for this fight, and they definitely scored a major, we're not going to say battlefield victory, but almost a mental victory. It really did something for the morale of these troops to beat back the British twice, and to kill 800 of them at point-blank range was just something that is going to resonate in the early part of the war. Along with all those killed, there's also about 60% officer casualties. You see, the Americans knew that if you take out the British officers, the troops, they actually fall into a state of confusion when they're making an attack because they're not getting their orders from anywhere. So what do? They'll fall back and reform. The Americans knew this. Their officers were former British officers, some of them, or had served with British officers during the French and Indian War. So they had a mind for the tactics of the British. So what they decide to do is to aim at the officers. It's actually a pretty sound tactic if you think about it. You have taken away their leadership advantage by taking out the leaders. It's a bit ghoulish as we think about it now to specifically aim for officers, but hey, it's what the Americans had to do. They had to press any advantage they had, and they were crack shots. Now, we had talked about the incident with the American artillery. You see, the American artillery under Scarborough Gridley, Samuel Trivett, and John Callender is going to be a bit of a mystery for the day. Scarborough Gridley will pull his men back, and for that he will be charged with cowardice and deficient of command, of which he's actually found guilty, but the thing of it was, he was a very young man. He had probably gotten to the position because his father was the chief engineer for the Army of Massachusetts. So when at his court-martial, they take away his artillery command, but they don't take away his chance for him to join the Continental Army, which is a good thing. I think he was deserved of another chance. John Callender, on the other hand, was found to be deficient of command and a coward for running and saying that he was out of ammunition, even though he wasn't. So at his court-martial, he's relieved of command and is told that he will not be eligible for a Continental Commission. But his sense of honor gets the better of him, and he will actually serve in as a volunteer with the Army into the New York campaign, where he will distinguish himself as a very brave man, and we'll talk about the Battle of New York and all its subsequent battles when we get to that point, but he's given back the opportunity to get a Continental Commission. He will actually even serve a year as a British prisoner, and he's gained back all of his honor that he lost that day running from the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, as for American casualties, they'll suffer 441 killed, captured, or wounded. And they will definitely feel the loss with losing Dr. Joseph Warren. Now, there is one loss on the British side that I failed to mention, and I just thought of it now, so I'd like to mention it, and that is Major John Pitcairn, the commander of the Marines. On the third assault, he is leading his men up and trying to get them over the redoubt, where he is wounded, and he shrugs off the wound and tries to rally his men and make that valiant charge against the redoubt, where he's hit four more times in the chest. Now, he doesn't die, but it doesn't look good for him. And his son actually rushes to his aid, carries him from the hill, and they get him on a boat back to Boston, where it's determined that he's mortally wounded. And he'll die not long after that with his son present. The loss of Pitcairn, at least early in the war, was definitely deeply felt across the British Army. He was a very beloved officer, and his loss will be felt, especially with his Marines. That's the Battle of Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill is going to rank among some of the worst, we'll say defeats. They were held on a similar scale as the French at Waterloo or the Union at Fredericksburg. They attacked this position that was unattainable, and they paid for it with many, many lives. Now, as for this week's book recommendation, I have given you With Fire and Sword, The Battle of Bunker Hill, by James L. Nielsen. I have also given you Decisive Day, The Battle of Bunker Hill by Robert Ketchum. And this one has not too much to do with the battle itself, but it's very poignant to this time frame that we are talking about. So I've chosen The Life of Artemus Ward, the First Commander-in-Chief of the American Revolution by Charles Martin. Now, Artemus Ward is not a super well-known figure, and I thought giving this recommendation would give a lot of people, if they want to read about this early figure, the chance to see that command decisions were difficult early on in the war, and this man rises to the occasion the best that he can. You see, I know in the first episode I was really harping on the fact that he wasn't sending troops to help out Prescott, but you got to remember, he's worried about this defensive line that's being held together by a hodgepodge of militiamen from New England. So he wants to make sure that they're not going to get overrun anywhere else. So though some command decisions are questionable during Bunker Hill, he is going to be one of the major generals that is going to be in the newly formed Continental Army. And we'll talk about more about that when we talk next week about the Continental Army that is going to form after this battle. The Second Continental Congress is in session currently, and the Battle of Bunker Hill is going to cement the fact that we need a uniform army and a strong leader to lead it. So next week, we're just going to have a general overview of the Continental Army. It's going to be just like one of our character studies. We're going to talk about a general history of the Continental Army, how it's formed, the reasonings, the way they do certain things, and how they come up with their decisions. But next week, we're going to see it as a character study of the Continental Army. And the week after, we're going to talk about George Washington. I'm going to make sure that I keep it relevant to our story arc. So I'm going to start from his early days and lead up to when he's elected to be the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. So that's the plan for the next 2 weeks. So everyone have a great week. And as always, keep your powder dry.